If you'll go ahead and turn in your Bibles today to the book of Lamentations. That's where we'll be spending our time today. Lamentations. You'll find it in between the book of Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Book of Lamentations. They shoved it there. It's a book of poetry, but many think that Jeremiah was the author. He may or may not have been, but that's where you'll find it. The book of Lamentations. Now, we just finished singing one of my favorite hymns. Stephen knows this. Great is thy faithfulness. And I think of that, you know, I think of the first verse. Great is thy faithfulness, O God, our Father. There is no shadow of turning with thee. Thou changest not thy compassions. They fail not. As thou hast been, thou forever will be. And I think about God's faithfulness and what it means in my life. And I find that oftentimes, the way that God's faithfulness, how it comes out in our language, how we think about God's faithfulness, or how we appear to think about God's faithfulness, is tied to what we hear and what we see in the here and the now. It's tied to what we hear and what we see in the here and the now. So when the car is working, God is faithful. When the harvest is bountiful, God is faithful. When the kids are doing well in school and they're healthy, God is faithful. In Angie's case, when the diagnosis is good, when the surgery goes well, God is faithful. But I wonder, what about when the here and now is not so pleasant? When the car is not working? When a sudden freeze comes in and we lose the whole crop? When the kids are expelled from school? When the diagnosis is the cancer has metastasized? Where do we look for comfort in the day of adversity? Where is our comfort? What about when it all happens at the same time? Where is our comfort in the day of adversity? It's a question that's explored in the book of Lamentations. It's a book that hasn't received much attention in the Christian community. And I ask, why is that? And I think it's because we think that it's a really depressing book. After all, it is the book that recounts Israel's darkest period in the entire Old Testament. The Babylonian exile. It was the event that we finished with in the book of 2 Kings. Nebuchadnezzar comes in, he trashes everything, and Israel's gone. The Jews read this book once a year. They read it on the ninth of the month of Av, which actually is coming up in 2 weeks. That would be the night of July 31st and the morning of August 1st. It swaps around every year, but that's when it's coming this year. Why do they do that? Well, it's because that's the anniversary of the Babylonian exile in 586 BC. But it's not just the anniversary of the Babylonian exile when the temple was destroyed. It's also the anniversary of when Rome came in and destroyed the temple in 70 AD. Same day. Exact same day. Now, when I think of Lamentations, I think of its reading. Sometimes they'll read it for a week. And that's why it used to be called the Wailing Wall. That western wall, the wall that's girding up the Temple Mount. And on top of the Temple Mount is where the temple was. That's the closest they could get. And they would come to this wall. They will read Lamentations. We don't really necessarily refer to it, or they don't, as the Wailing Wall anymore. Because in 1967, since they've reoccupied Jerusalem, they kind of feel like they've returned. You know, the temple's not there. And as if you're following the news, there's all kinds of conflict going on right now over that Temple Mount. Some Muslims were firing off some weapons, killed a couple guys from there. So now they've put up metal detectors and there's a big thing going on. But that's what I think of. I think of the Jews once a year. I also think, do you know, the Roman Catholics read this once a year. It's part of their liturgy. During Holy Week, that week that's leading up to Easter. Now, why would they use Lamentations as a liturgy leading up to Easter? They're not like mourning over Jerusalem, right? Like a Jew would be. Why would they do that? They interpret this in a different way. They're going to interpret it in such a way that the book is really about Christ. Okay? They're going to use a different kind of hermeneutic to try to arrive there. And really, they're looking to feel really sad during the week before the resurrection. If you want to feel really sad, Lamentations is about the saddest book in the Bible. So that's where you could go. But as we'll find today, I don't think that this book was included in the canon to help us feel bad. I think it was included to give the Jewish exiles hope. And I think it was included to give us hope. And I think it has a powerful message for us today, especially where depression and suicide is rising among teens and among adults. Partly because of the way our social media is affecting our society. You get on there on Facebook and everybody is presenting themselves like their life is great. So when you blow it, and you blow it big time, you think you can't recover. And you don't have any hope. And so I ask, as we approach this book, where do we look for comfort on the day of adversity? And when we're approaching a book that's named so strangely, Lamentations, the name just comes from the very first line in the book. It's like, how? And I ask myself, what is a lament? What is that? And when I think of a lament, the first modern example comes from the play Les Mis. Are y'all familiar with Les Mis? I think they recently made, semi-recently, a movie. It's a musical, but you know, it has like Russell Crowe and Anthony Hopkins. And is Liam Neeson in that? Or am I making that up? I don't know. Anyway, if you haven't seen it, you should. It's a story about the French Revolution, okay? And the failed portion of this. So when I think about a lament, I'm thinking of a character whose name is Marius. And Marius is like the poster boy for the revolution. He's the spokesperson. So he and his friends are up and they're speaking to the people and they're trying to encourage this revolt. And on the day of the revolution, he goes to the barricade with his friends to fight together. And he gets knocked unconscious. And another character pulls him away from the front lines. So by the time that Marius wakes up, the revolution is over. It failed. And all his friends are dead. And he has this intense grief over the fact that he didn't die with them. And so, in a scene, he goes to a pub where he and his friends used to get together. And they would plot and plan this revolution that they were going to change society with together. And the whole place is just wiped out. And he's looking around and he sings a lament. And the lament is called Empty Chairs at Empty Tables. And it goes, the first couple lines are kind of like this. There's a grief that can't be spoken. There's a pain that goes on and on. Empty chairs at empty tables. Now my friends are dead and gone. Here they talked of revolution. Here it was they lit the flame. And here they sang about tomorrow. But tomorrow never came. That's what I think of. That's what a lament is. A lament is this expression of sorrow. It's a funeral song. And Lamentations is a funeral song for the city of Jerusalem. It's a collection of several funeral songs. Actually, there's five of them, one for each chapter. So we're going to look at that today. And we're going to see what the author is telling us through these funeral songs, how we can minister to this adversity. Basically, the author is going to give us a theological answer. He's giving these Jewish exiles this theological answer to the question that's on all of their lips. Because what they see and what they hear is not consistent with what they have believed. Okay, things are really bad. They didn't think it could ever get this bad. Listen to this. Chapter 2, verse 14. He says, part of the reason it's this way is your prophets have seen for you false and foolish visions. They have not exposed your iniquity so as to restore you from captivity, but they have seen for you false and misleading oracles. If you were reading through the book of Jeremiah, Jeremiah was a contemporary of those last few kings, and he keeps coming up to him. He says, look, you're going into exile. Things are bad. You guys are sinning. You need to repent. You need to return to the Lord. There are all these false prophets though around here saying, no. Things are good. God is pleased with us. We need to resist any kind of occupation. All right, this guy's crazy. Okay? And the author here is saying, no, 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 no. These guys have been lying to you. So these Jewish exiles are saying, what's going on? We thought everything was great. Why has this happened? How can it be that this would happen? They don't know that they were in the wrong at this point. Saying they've been lying to you. It was unthinkable that the Lord would allow His city, Jerusalem, to be destroyed. That the temple would be destroyed. That the sacrifices would cease. Unthinkable. This is unprecedented in their history. Nothing like this has ever happened. The entire story, when we're looking at it, right? We're looking for that Messiah to come. That 3:15 seed of the woman. And we know that He's going to come through a people. Abraham was promised that his children would become a nation. Through them all the families of the earth would be blessed. And we watched as God took this small family. He put them in Egypt. He made a nation out of them. He delivered them from that incredible Gentile superpower. He gave them His special dwelling. He gave them a law, the revelation of His character, so that they know how they are to represent them. He gave them a land, a place to rule over the nations from. And He put a king on top of them, one who'd be His representative. All of this has been moving in that direction, the whole story, and now it's gone. What have we been doing all this time? Where is Messiah? You know, everything's gone. We don't have a land, a people, a nation. They're in captivity. They're scattered. So in the midst of all these things, and in the midst of adversity, the people need to know why God has done this. They need to know why there's still hope in the here and now, when things are really bad, when they can't see it, when the here and now aren't pleasant, and what they hear and see is terrible. They need to know where comfort should come from. They need to know where to look in the day of adversity. So if you look at chapter 1, this first lament, the author is going to picture Jerusalem as a woman. Just listen to the first three verses. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. She has become like a widow who was once great among the nations. She who was a princess among the provinces, she has become forced labor. She weeps bitterly in the night, and her tears are on her cheeks. She has none to comfort her among her lovers. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Judah has gone into exile under affliction and under harsh servitude. She dwells among the nations, but she has found no rest. All her pursuers have overtaken her in the midst of her distress. The author says that it began like the Real Housewives of the ancient Near East, okay? So, Jerusalem wants to be part of the nation's clique. She wants to go hang around with these other ladies. And while they act like they're her friends to her face, in their heart they hate her, okay? They're being run by Satan. We are not friends, okay? So they hate her, and at the first opportunity, they turn on her. And now the latest gossip is that the girl who was once the princess of the provinces, she's been rejected by everybody. Her lovers don't want her anymore. Her friends have become her enemies. Verse 1 says she became like a widow, meaning even her husband has rejected her. She's not a widow. He just doesn't want to have anything to do with her anymore. He's not dead, but he might as well be. He's not protecting her. He's not providing for her. Okay? Look at verse 7. In the days of her affliction and homelessness, Jerusalem remembers all her precious things that were from the days of old, when her people fell into the hand of the adversary and no one helped her. The adversaries saw her. They mocked at her ruin. Jerusalem sinned greatly. Therefore, she has become an unclean thing. All who honored her despise her because they have seen her nakedness. Even she herself groans and turns away. Her uncleanness was in her skirts. She did not consider her future. Therefore, she has fallen astonishingly. She has no comforter. Jerusalem has become like a vagrant that wanders the streets. And she's remembering the days gone by. I remember how it all went wrong. I had it all. I lost it all. The woman who once was the desire of the nations has been around the block now. Right? They're not interested in her anymore. They've seen her nakedness, it says. They've all been with her. And she's picked up a few things from them. Now she's not desirable anymore. Instead, she's rejected. She's despised. Nobody wants her. Everybody mocks her. You know, it's like a cast out in high school, right? She's in the midst of adversity. She has no place to turn for comfort. Verse 16, notice it. For these things I weep. My eyes run down with water because far from me is a comforter, one who restores my soul. My children are desolate because the enemy has prevailed. Verse 17, Zion stretches out her hands. There is no one to comfort her. The Lord has commanded concerning Jacob that the ones round about him should be his adversaries. Jerusalem has become an unclean thing among them. Verse 19, I called to my lovers. They deceived me. Look at 21. They have heard that I groan, and there's no one to comfort me. All my enemies have heard of my calamity, and they're glad that you have done it. Oh, that you would bring the day which you have proclaimed, that they may become like me. Let all their wickedness come before you, and deal with them as you've dealt with me for all my transgressions. For my groans are many, and my heart is faint. She's been looking for love in all the wrong places, and of course, the only thing she finds is trouble. Okay? She's going around to these people who don't know the Lord, and she finds herself with the enemies of the Lord, becoming an enemy of the Lord. Okay? She feels like it's over. She no longer hopes that her situation will improve. If you look at it, she feels that she's blown it. I've blown it badly. I can't rectify the situation. What does she hope for now? She wants just to see the world burn. At this point, I'm being judged. I know that I've blown it too badly. I just want to make sure everybody else is judged too. She was supposed to be the salvation of the world, right? But right now, what she sees and what she hears is that she is the enemy of the world. They all hate her. The Lord is judging her. And she is looking forward, trying to comfort herself with the thought that, well, I know in the future they'll be judged too, and I at least will be being judged together. And that's how the first lament ends. Not necessarily a positive and uplifting and comforting and hopeful message. Yet. And the second lament, as we'll find, is like the first. We're not adding anything new as we're going through these things. Things are bad. And we're looking around and it just gets worse. How can it get worse? Well, the second lament is going to focus on God's role in Jerusalem's troubles. Listen to it. Chapter 2. How the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in His anger. He has cast from heaven to earth the glory of Israel and has not remembered His footstool in the day of His anger. The Lord has swallowed up. He has not spared all the inhabitants of Jacob. In His wrath, He has thrown down the strongholds of the daughters of Judah. He has brought them down to the ground. He has profaned the kingdom and its princes. And the author is reminding them, look, don't get it twisted. This hasn't come about from some territorial God that has overcome Yahweh. Okay? It's not that the God that the Babylonians worshipped have succeeded. That was a former king of Judah's problem, as he was worried about the gods of Assyria. They seem to be winning. Maybe we need to pay a little homage that way. He says, no, 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 no. God's sovereign. He's running the joint. And right now, He's destroying the joint. Same God still in charge. Nothing's changed. Notice it. Verse 5. The Lord's become like an enemy. And if you follow down verse 5 all the way to verse 9, you're going to find that He's wiping out every cultic symbol of Jewish identity that they have. He created a people from nothing to be a kingdom of priests, and they're not. So He can take it all away. It's like Job. Now the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. The only difference is Job wasn't being judged for being wicked. They're in a worse spot. You know, Peter says, look, it's better to suffer without doing wrong. You know, if you got to suffer, don't suffer for being a thief or a murderer, etc. They're suffering because they've done wrong. So, as we read it down, he destroys their palaces, their strongholds. He destroyed the tabernacle, verse 6. He caused feast and Sabbath to cease, verse 7. He rejected his altar. He abandons the Holy of Holies. Verse 8, he destroys Jerusalem's wall. Verse 9, look at it. Mid-verse, her king and her princes are among the nations. The law is no more. Also, her prophets find no vision from the Lord. Her king and her princes are among the nations. Look at what he'll say in chapter 4, verse 20. He'll say, the breath of our nostrils, the Lord's anointed, was captured in their pits, of whom we had said, under his shadow we shall live among the nations. The Lord's anointed, the king, and eventually we would expect it to be God's Messiah. The breath of our nostrils. James will say, the body without the breath is dead. It's dead. He's saying, Jerusalem has died. And all of this, of course, is very troubling. And amidst the author, he says, look, I'm suffering with you. I feel it. I see it. I hear it. Listen, verse 11 of chapter 2. My eyes fail because of tears. My spirit is greatly troubled. My heart is poured out on the earth because of the destruction of the daughter of my people. When little ones and infants faint in the streets of the city, they say to their mothers, where is grain and wine? As they faint like a wounded man in the streets of the city, as their life is poured out on their mother's bosom. Chapter 3, verse 1, he'll say, I am the man who has seen affliction because of the rod of God's wrath. The author says, I feel it. I see it. But none of this should come as a surprise to us. It shouldn't be a surprise. Look at the end of chapter 2, 17. Chapter 2, verse 17, the author says, look, Yahweh has done what he has purposed. He has accomplished his word, which he commanded from days of old. He has thrown down without sparing, and he has caused the enemy to rejoice over you. He has exalted the might of your adversaries. He told us that this would happen from the beginning? Where? When? In the law. Hold your finger in Lamentations and look at Deuteronomy, if you will. Deuteronomy chapter 31. Deuteronomy chapter 31, and I'm going to start in verse 16. Deuteronomy 31, verse 16. This is Moses is at the end of his reign. Okay, and the Lord's giving, you know, that second generation has risen up. Deuteronomy, the second law. They're receiving the law. They're about to move into the land under Joshua. Deuteronomy 31, verse 16. The Lord said to Moses, behold, you are about to lie down with your fathers, and this people will arise and play the harlot with the strange gods of the land, into the midst of which they're going, and will forsake me and break my covenant which I've made with them. Then my anger will be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them and hide my face from them, and they will be consumed, and many evils and troubles will come upon them, so that they will say in that day, is it not because our God is not among us that these evils have come upon us? But I will surely hide my face in that day because of all the evil which they will do, for they will turn to other gods. Now therefore write this song for yourselves and teach it to the sons of Israel. Put it on their lips so that this song may be a witness for me against the sons of Israel. For when I bring them into the land flowing with milk and honey, which I swore to their fathers, and they have eaten and are satisfied and become prosperous, when the here and now is really great, then they will turn to serve other gods and serve them and spurn me and break my covenant. Then it will come about when many evils and troubles have come upon them that this song will testify before them as a witness. for it shall not be forgotten from the lips of their descendants. For I know their intent which they are developing today, before I have brought them into the land which I swore." So Moses writes this song down. The song is Deuteronomy 32. Deuteronomy 32 is the history of the world before it happens. It's the history of the Old Testament before it happens. And Moses is going to say, look down at it. Verse 25 of chapter 31. Moses commanded the Levites who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, saying, "Look, take this book of the law, place it beside the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord God, that it may remain there as a witness against you. For I know your rebellion and your stubbornness. Behold, while I'm still alive with you today, you've been rebellious against the Lord. How much more after my death? Assemble to me the elders of your tribes and your officers, that I may speak these words in their hearings and call the heavens and the earth to witness against them." We're going to see that a lot in the prophets. The heavens and the earth as a witness. Okay, God's going to be the prosecutor, the judge. The heavens and the earth are there to say, he's doing right. It's just. They're witnessing his just judgment. "For I know that after my death," verse 29, "you will act corruptly and turn from the way which I have commanded you. And evil will befall you in the latter days. For you'll do that which is evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him to anger with the work of your hands." And then Moses spoke in the hearing of all the assembly of Israel the words of the song until they were complete. So he says, I'm going to tell you ahead of time. I know you're going in. I've been with you all this time. I know you're rebellious, and the Lord's told me you're going to mess up anyway. Here's a song to remember. And what the author of Lamentations is going to do, you have a sheet there. He's going through Deuteronomy. He is saying, look, he's bewailing their situation, but he's bewailing it through the Deuteronomy 28 curses. You know, you had the blessings and the curses, the statutes of the covenant given in Deuteronomy 28. You got about 15 blessings and then about 40 or so, 60 verses, something like that, of curses, because that's going to be their experience for the majority of their time in the land. They're going to be rebellious. And the author is going to go through this. He's going to say, do you see that this is happening? This is what the Lord said would happen. Do you see this? This is what the Lord said would happen. We're dwelling among the nations. Verse 3 of Lamentations. That's Deuteronomy 28:65. Among those nations you shall find no rest. They're saying, we don't have rest. He says, I know. It's because the Lord is against you. And I won't read it all. I just listed about 20 of them. There's, of course, more. But he's listing them out. And he's confessing for them and with them. Notice the table at the bottom. You know, this is, I got a chapter, from every chapter of the book, a confession. The Lord has brought her grief, verse 5 at the table in the bottom. The Lord has brought Jerusalem grief. Why? Because of her many sins. I know your prophets were telling you that you're okay. They were wrong. They were false prophets. How do I know? Where in the world are we? Things aren't okay right now, are they? They're really bad. They said it was going to be okay. We're cool with God. We're obviously not cool with God because we have the entire table of Deuteronomy 28 against us. And it's terrible. So let us consider then. Perhaps we have sin. What should we do? We need to turn to the Lord. But the Lord is our enemy. The Lord is the one bringing this upon us. So what should we do then? How do we deal with this situation? You know, now that they've blown it big, and the day of the adversity is upon them. They are experiencing, when we think of the day of the Lord, that concept, normally we think of like end time stuff, right? The day of the Lord, where he comes and judges the nations. But we'll find there are many days of the Lord. A day of the Lord is the time where God comes and settles accounts. He's going to judge. And it's kind of like, it's echoes throughout history, right? History doesn't repeat itself. It echoes. So we have these many days of the Lord, these many times of judgment that are prefiguring that great day of the Lord when the King returns and all accounts are settled. So we have a day of the Lord. And we're looking at these confessions. Verse 18 at the bottom. The Lord is righteous, yet I rebelled. Jerusalem has rebelled. I have been most rebellious. And even that confession we read, you know, he's trying to get them to judge the nations because they're obviously wicked. But judge them the same way you judged me because I was wicked. So I see that the day of adversity has come upon Israel. It is the will of the Lord. Where should they look for comfort or hope then if the Lord is against them? And the author of Lamentations is going to tell us. Now, I mentioned at the beginning, Lamentations, it's five laments, right? Each chapter records a lament. I want you to notice their structure. Flip back to Lamentations with me. Look at chapter 1. Okay? How many verses are in chapter 1? 22. Chapter 2. 22. Chapter 3. 66. Chapter 4. 22. Chapter 5. 22. Now, some of you may be thinking, all right, wait a minute, Caleb. Chapters and verses weren't added until later, so I don't know what you're doing, but we can't really trust these chapters and verses. Well, that might be the case in some situations, but we're looking at poetry. Okay, this isn't historical narrative. This is a book of poetry. And each verse in these 22 verses and then the 66 in chapter 3 is going to represent a stanza of poetry. Okay? First stanza, second stanza, on and on. Why 22 stanzas? Well, 22 stanzas because there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. And what we'll find, if this was not written in English, if you could see the Hebrew, that the stanzas in the chapter 1 is going to follow an acrostic. It's going down the Hebrew alphabet. So the first stanza, chapter 1, is going to have three lines in the stanza, but the first word in the first line is going to be basically the A. So it would be like A, line, line, B, line, line, C, and on and on and on for 22 stanzas. When we come to chapter 2, it will do the exact same thing again. Acrostic A, then another line, line, B, line, line. When we come to chapter 3, 66 verses, individual lines, and it's going to go A, 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 B, 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 C, C, C. Acrostic, but letter each line. When you come to chapter 4, we're going to step back and go back to the original pattern, but the stanzas are shorter. It's going to go A, line, B, line, C, line. What do you think happens when you get to chapter 5? Goes off the tracks. No more acrostic. It's the shortest chapter. So I look at this. I notice that the author is intentionally building this in a structure. Why use an acrostic anyway? What would be the purpose of structuring something like that? That's right. Memory. Same reason that some preachers have, you know, all their points start with the same letter. Three P's, you know, in their sermons. So that you can remember them. So they are to remember what this author is telling them. And knowing this, the next question that I have is, well, what chapter then becomes the focus of the book? Normally when I'm thinking of a book, you know, I go through it to the end. We're going from chapter 1 to chapter 5. By chapter 5, Paul or whoever has made his theological point. Now we're here in application. This is the end. Take this to the bank. Look at how chapter 5 ends of Lamentations. You, O Lord, verse 19, you, O Lord, rule forever. Your throne is from generation to generation. Why do you forget us forever? Why do you forsake us so long? Restore us to you, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days of old, unless you have utterly rejected us and are exceedingly angry with us. That's not a very hopeful or comforting thought. What if the Lord has completely rejected us? And chapter 5, if you were to go through it, it's that short chapter, but it's basically just going through all the suffering that this author has experienced. He's saying, please remember this, Lord. Look at all this judgment that's befallen us. Please restore us at the end. But maybe, you know, you're just too angry and that won't happen. I think, man. But it's interesting. Chapter 5 isn't an acrostic, is it? What does that mean? If I'm to forget something in Lamentations, I might forget the fifth chapter with all the recounting of suffering. This time where the author is worried, maybe the Lord has utterly rejected us. It's going to be a memory one day. because of what we find out in chapter 3 at the center point, the focus. Now, chapter 3, as I mentioned, it is that heavy acrostic AAABBB. Look at what the author says in the middle. He's going to tell us where we should look in the day of adversity. Chapter 3, I'll start in verse 17. This was the author at first. He's thinking about how difficult his situation is and what he sees and hears in the here and now. Verse 17, he says, "My soul has been rejected from peace. I've forgotten happiness. So I say my strength has perished, and so has my hope from the Lord." Verse 19. "Remember intentionally, Lord, remember my affliction and my wandering, the wormwood and bitterness. Surely my soul remembers, it's bowed down within me. Lord, please put your mind on this." Verse 21. "You know what I'll put my mind on, Lord? This I recall to my mind, and therefore I have hope. The Lord's loving kindnesses indeed never cease, for His compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is Your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I have hope in Him." So I ask the author of Lamentations, where should I look for comfort in the day of adversity? He says, you look to the law of God, the revelation of the character of God. It's about the character of God. You got to know Him. What's He like? Who is this God? When I hear and see trouble in the here and now, God is faithful. The Lord, gracious and true. He's kind, He's faithful. He's extending loving kindness to generation after generation. But He's just. He will repay those who hate Him. But nonetheless, He's compassionate and merciful. He will restore. He is a faithful God. The author's going to say, look down at verse 31 of chapter 3. "The Lord will not reject forever, for if He causes grief, then He will have compassion according to His abundant love and kindness," that chesed love. "For He does not act willingly or grieve the sons of men, to crush under His feet all the prisoners of the land, to deprive a man of justice in the presence of the Most High, to defraud a man in his lawsuit. Of these things the Lord does not approve. Who is there who speaks and it comes to pass unless the Lord commanded it? Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that both good and ill go forth? Why should any living mortal man offer complaint in view of his sins? Let us examine and probe our ways, and let us return to the Lord." He's saying, the Lord is not arbitrary or capricious or malevolent. He's not a bad father that just disciplines the child and the child has no idea what's going on. You know, slaps him on the head. "Why'd you do it, Dad? You know." And then he lets him go see if he can figure it out. The Lord doesn't want to do that. When He disciplines with a purpose. So I ask, as we move towards our conclusion, what was the purpose for God's judgment on Jerusalem? Why? How? It was so that the nation would realize there's no one besides God who can deliver. They haven't figured it out yet. Look at verse 17 of chapter 4. Lamentations chapter 4, verse 17. The author confesses, "Our eyes failed, for help was useless. In our watching, we have watched, for a nation could not save." Remember, they were hoping that Egypt might help them? Egypt can't save. Assyria can't save. Yahweh saves. And Yahweh has told him this. Listen to the song, remember? Moses wrote a song. He drilled it into their head. This is Deuteronomy 32. It's that song we talked about. The song that goes through the history of Israel. And in Deuteronomy 32, verse 36, he's going to say this. "For the Lord will vindicate His people and will have compassion on His servants when He sees that their strength is gone and there's none remaining, bond or free. And He will say, 'Where are their gods? The rock in which they sought refuge, Who ate the fat of their sacrifices and drank the wine of their drink offering? Let them rise up and help you. Let them be your hiding place. See now that I am he, and there is no God besides me. It is I who put to death and give life. I have wounded, and it is I who heal. And there is no one who can deliver from my hand. The only one who could help Jerusalem was the one that they had turned their backs on. Israel needed to return to God, who would have compassion on them and restore them so that they can be His covenant people through whom the Messiah will come, through whom the salvation of the world will come. The city which it said, and even the author confesses, chapter 2, just listen to it, of Lamentations, chapter 2, verse 15, the nations are mocking, is this not the city which they said, the perfection of beauty, a joy to all the earth? They're going to save us? This people? They can't even save themselves. Ridiculous. They needed to turn back to God. He's the one who could save them, and He is the only one who could save them. He put the curse on them. He's the one that can deliver them. That's our situation too. He put the curse on us. We rebelled against Him. He has judged the world. We are looking for that rest, but He has also provided that deliverance. The rest only comes through one way. The one who made the curse is the one who can remove the curse, and that curse is removed through His Son, Jesus the Christ. We know the story's moving. It's not here yet. Lamentations is here to say, what about when things are terrible? How would I use this book? When is this book relevant to me as a Christian? When it's hit the fan. When your life has fallen apart. When you got nothing. Your family's left you. Your kids have become your enemies. You've lost your job. The roof is caving in. And I read. And it's bad. And the author doesn't say it's not bad. We have this idea that, you know, men don't cry, that kind of stuff. That's not Christian. That's Stoic Greek philosophy. As though there's some kind of, there's something noble about not being affected by your emotions. The prophets are affected by their emotions. This prophet can't see because he's crying all day. But this is the same guy, most likely Jeremiah, who's walking to the kings, the ones who can kill him, who hate him, and he's telling them how it is. He's going to the boss of the boss who can do whatever they want to do to him. He says, you guys got problems. They're manly men. Right? Elijah was a wild man. He's going around in the wilderness. He's wearing all camel hair. He's eating bugs. Shows up, looks like a crazy man. But they're in touch with their emotions. It's okay to grieve. The author here is not saying it's not. He's saying things are bad. Let's just be honest. Tell the Lord. The Lord wants to know. He'll listen. Things are bad, God. Maybe He'll show compassion. Because I know He's a compassionate God. I know He's a merciful God. And you know what else this book tells me about God? He is the sovereign God. He's the only one. So He's the one. He's my only hope for deliverance. He's who Jerusalem was to turn to. He's to we, who we are to turn to. I think of that hymn we began our time with today, the one that comes from this. You know, I think of great is thy faithfulness, and we're thinking of all the faithfulness of the great things God has done. That was written in times of tragedy, really. That's when God's faithful. Remember, God is faithful. Think of that last verse. Pardon for sin and a peace that endureth, thine own dear presence to cheer and to guide. When? In the day of adversity. Strength for today in the day of adversity, and bright hope for tomorrow. Blessings all mine with 10,000 beside. It's not best life now for the Christian. It's best life in the future. Where Christ is, when He comes, when He sets up His kingdom. That's our hope. Resurrection hope. I hope you got it. Only comes through faith in Him.